Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thank you for listening to this podcast of Real Recovery. There are many more podcasts available at myfaithradio.com. Your support makes this possible. Thank you.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Real Recovery.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone. Help. When I was young, was so much younger than today.
Hello and welcome to Real Recovery. Another award-winning show is on the way. Bill Arnold on this side of the studio. And just across the way, George P. Fraser, a man with a lot of time on his hands. He's currently being considered chairman of the Department of Fun and Leisure.
Should be. That's a good fit.
That would be a perfect title for you and a perfect job.
Might be more work than I'm ready for.
How you been?
I haven't seen
you
in a while.
Yeah, I know.
You look good.
Thank you. I feel good. And you, sir?
How do you feel? Good.
Okay, good.
So you're saying I don't look good?
No, I'm not saying that, but I'm inferring it.
Okay.
Yeah. So, George, I got to say, if I was a lawyer, which I'm not because I'm not smart enough to go to law school, you know that.
What, that you're not a lawyer? I'm not touching the other part.
No, that A, I'm not a lawyer, and B, I'm not smart enough to go to law school.
You know
but
what?
But if I was.
Okay.
And if I was a judge and I got to judgeship, I would have to recuse myself from tonight's story because the person in the studio that's going to tell his story, I feel very close to.
Yeah, I like the guy, too. How can you not?
I love him, and his story is going to blow you away.
Yeah, you know, every time I've tried to be a lawyer, Bill, I've wound up meeting one. So
yeah,
I'm with you on that.
Yeah, so let's talk about step one. We always talk about one step on Real Recovery every week, and today we're going to jump into step one. Georgie, you're the step man, so go ahead.
Well, step one is we admitted we were powerless over drugs and alcohol and that our life was unmanageable. Well, okay, so we come into this and go, I can't drink anymore. I can't do drugs. Okay, I get that. Might not like it, but I get it. The question I always have, Bill, is what do we have power over? That's where you participate.
Well, we have, I don't know, George, where do we have power over?
I don't think we have power over anything. I think our next breath comes at the mercy of an all-sovereign God.
That's true.
God has power over everything. So most of the guys we work with get the first part. I've got a problem with this. And maybe you're not an alcoholic or drug addict, but maybe you have a problem with anger or pride or lust or greed. Or maybe we're talking about me again. I don't know. But, you know, we all have something because all falls short of the glory of God. What is it? And if you're a Christian, Bill, your life should have changed. You should be different than before you were a Christian. And one of the things that we look at is we're always working on being more Christ-like. Paul said, press on towards the goal. The goal is to be more Christ-like. So it's a sanctification process, being more holy. The second part of the step, our life is unmanageable, gets overlooked a lot. And what does that mean? What that means is, to me, anytime I see something I don't like or someone I don't like,
why are you looking at me?
I'm just looking at you because I'm looking across the studio. I'm looking that God allowed that. And I believe, Bill, the reason we're unhappy and try to control things is we're really judging that what God has presented in front of us isn't good enough for us. And working on this in my recovery, I sin when I fantasize, making things different. And where I'm really trying to go with this for us tonight is acceptance. Accepting that God has allowed what is happening for his purpose right now. And how can I glorify God and accept what he has for me? And there's a lot of things that happen in life that we don't like, but we want to look for the reason that God allowed it and what can we do to help glorify him. I go to a treatment center on Fridays called Redemption House, and their slogan is, we worship our way out of addiction for his glory and our joy. And I think, Bill, that ties in, that if we just stop the behavior, we've missed the greater part of why God allowed our addiction to happen. We have a huge piece in it, obviously. I'm not looking to discredit my piece, but God allowed it. And for a lot of us, myself included, I wouldn't be saved if I hadn't become an addict. And I think God allows these things to get our attention, to focus on him and not us. Make any sense to you?
It makes a lot of sense. And through your suffering that you went through, you have come out on the other side with great blessing, haven't you?
Oh, absolutely.
And I think that's the story of a lot of people in recovery.
Well, I think it'll be our story tonight with our guest, too. But I always want to remember, okay, if you have a problem and you're falling short of the glory of God, the realization that you have that when other people have been telling you that for years, when all of a sudden you get that, that's the Holy Spirit convicting you. And if you're listening tonight, and maybe you've had periods of sobriety, and you've struggled, and you've gone back to using, and you get sober and you go back, here's the good news that maybe you've missed. The reason you want to quit in the first place is the Holy Spirit has convicted you that this is wrong and there's a better way. What you need to do is not work so much on quitting your problem, but building your relationship with the living God. I always tell the guys I work with, you need to focus on your recovery, not your problem. You need to focus on the solution, not the problem. And the solution for us is Christ.
Yeah, you have to focus on what you want versus what you don't want. Think about that one, George.
Sound like Mick Jagger over there.
Yeah? But isn't there a little bit of truth to that?
Yeah, I think so. For me, I love drinking because I like the buzz, the escape, the celebration, socialization, the snappy patter.
Really?
I love gambling. Oh,
you should
yeah.
bring some of that to the studio sometime.
Yeah, I yeah. should, but we don't want to be too highly rated, Bill. But I think you need to get out of your recovery what you were trying to get out of your using. And I looked at John 10:10. You know, the thief came to kill, murder, and destroy, but the Son of Man came to give us life and give it to us abundantly. I think the Christian life, Bill, is the only abundant life. But for most of us, it's a have to, it's plan B. But when we really start getting that God is with us, brought us into it, and he has a plan on our life to glorify him and to bring us joy, well, then we're on our way.
Mm-hmm. I've been reading Psalm 101 lately, George, and in that, there's this great verse in 3 that says, I will not set before my eyes anything that is worthless. Talk about what a great, you know. What a,
how do you feel looking at me?
It's not easy, let me tell
no,
you.
No, that's a challenge.
But when you think about being proactive against sin, it's like, what are you putting in front of your eyes? I always say,
wow.
I've said this before to the men that I talk to on Fridays, be very careful where your feet go, because where your feet go is where the rest of your body is going to go. So even when you're putting on your shoes in the morning and tying up your laces, pray a blessing over your feet, because where your feet are is where the rest of you is going to be. That's my profound thought for the night.
I love it. Well, it's the old thing, you know, you keep going to the barber shop, you're going to get a haircut.
Mm-hmm.
People we hang around, we always tell guys you need to find a new playground, new playmates, and new playthings, and we need to do things different. Bill, one of the guys that really helped me when I was struggling mightily was a guy named Bob Johnson. He was a Catholic Christian, and he always used to say, George, hang with the winners. And Scripture tells us that bad company corrupts good character. And if you don't have good character, which I didn't and I'm still working on, you're known by who you hang out with. And I remember one of the first conversations we ever had, you and I, you asked me why I didn't talk more about holiness. And I said to you, something I've probably said twice in my life, I don't know. And you started giving me these Keller tapes, and you really ministered to me on that. I need people around that sharpen me. What's that, Proverbs 27:17, Bill?
Mm-hmm.
Just as iron sharpens iron, so one man another. Maybe the reason, if you're listening tonight, you don't have the joy and the growth and the success you want in your recovery is you don't have good enough teammates.
Yeah, having meaningful friends in your life is important. I had a guest on this week that talked about there's no such thing as a casual relationship work. You know, you have to be intentional with who you spend time with. You want to remove ungodly people from your life. You want to be in a place where you are walking with people who are faithful to the Lord, can lead you to a place of greater obedience in your life than lesser obedience, right?
Right.
And it seems that when you're hanging around casual kinds of relationships, that is when you are most likely to be tempted or led astray. Because your dear, good friends aren't going to say, hey, let's go off and sin.
Yeah, they're going to say, why are you doing that?
Right.
Or you're doing it again. In our recovery program, we have mentors and sponsors and things like that. And my mentor is a guy named Danny, and he always will tell me, how's that working for you? You know, what did you think would happen?
Right.
That's a good one. And we used to work on what I was thinking, and now we're working on what I'm saying, because he said just because you think it, you don't have to say it.
Right.
And I'm working on that one.
That's good.
So don't push me.
I don't plan to.
Okay.
Yeah. This is a Real Recovery. Bill and George, got Ted on the board. We've got a wonderful guest in studio we can hardly wait to get to, so let's take a short break. We'll be back in 90 seconds.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Real Recovery.
George, you might as well take us back. This is the song you requested. You go ahead.
Bob Seger.
Yeah.
And
do the welcome back to Real Recovery thing.
Well, welcome back to Real Recovery tonight.
That's not bad.
Needs Bill, work. George,
needs work.
Ted. Yeah, it does need work. That's why I don't do it. I'm not a radio guy. And our guest tonight is Rick. And the reason we played that song, that'll tie into some of the story here. And I share similar struggles in my life, so I can't wait to hear this. Rick, thanks for doing the show.
You're welcome. Great to be here.
Yeah, three brothers in Christ. This is exciting.
Yeah, I love this.
Yeah. It is. Well, four. Ted.
Well, four, yeah. Yeah, but I mean, yeah.
Ted, you were, when I saw you a month ago, he was.
The minute Ted talks, he's the fourth.
Hey, yeah. I'm in. All right.
All right, cool. He's in now. All right.
So we're good.
Yeah, we're good. So, Rick, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And I have to say, I met you 6-7 months ago, and I was instantly engaged in who you were. Because you were very interested in having a solid, strong recovery. And that is not always a person's first response.
Yeah, I was very, very broken down, beaten down, and homeless, and was ready to change, desperately ready to change. And so I came in the door hungry and desperate for change. Yeah.
All right, we're going to want to hear the story.
Absolutely. Yeah. So real hard guy not to like. One of those people, when you meet him, you really like him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, unlike you and I. We never had that problem.
Has anyone ever said that about you?
No, we never had that problem. Yeah. So, where'd you grow up?
Grew up in Edina.
Edina, I've heard of that.
Yeah, I have too.
Yeah.
Suburb of Minneapolis.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah. And had a great family, a nice family situation. Was a hockey player, soccer player.
Soccer?
Yeah, a little soccer too, a little tennis. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I like them even more.
A little country club action
right.
here.
Yeah. Yeah. We played on the city park, so no country club, but it was a fun way to grow up, man.
Have to weed the tennis courts.
Had to weed the tennis courts, yeah. Or slide on the clay, one or the other.
Mm-hmm. Love it.
Yep, fun stuff. So yeah, good. It was good growing up, but I kind of knew something was wrong early on in life. I had an issue definitely with anger, and always kind of knew it was there and just kind of underneath the surface. And I was kind of my own rule writer, if you will. Always wanted to play by my rules and nobody else's rules. And throughout my life, that started to cause problems, particularly with physical violence, fights. Were kind of where I all started. It was kind of going to be my way. And yet, if you knew me, you liked me. I was a good guy. I got along with everybody. I was quote-unquote popular, a good athlete. I was doing what you do on the weekends with other kids. I was drinking and partying at a very, very early age.
What's a very early age?
For me, it was 15. And I remember getting really intoxicated or drunk where I was puking my guts out at the age of 15. And I remember a friend just swatting mosquitoes off my back all night, trying to get me sober enough to get home. So, you didn't think I was going to go that right. If you would have asked me, I was always an athlete. I wasn't a quote unquote burnout. In fact, I got along with all the burnouts. I got along with all the jocks. I got along with all the smart kids. I kind of liked everybody. But I was just taking on some behaviors that I didn't. You know, at the time, I thought I was just being one of the guys, just a normal, regular teenager. I thought it was cool that we'd go out and get kegs every weekend and drink and smoke a little weed or whatever it was we were doing. But there was a real edge to it, and then I had a real kind of a darker, negative side to me that didn't want to be, you know, any part of that, yet I still enjoyed because I think I wanted people's praise. I wanted to be liked. I wanted to be loved. And so I wanted to be included and involved, even though, you know, if you would have asked me, I would have told you, no, I don't, you know, I would have probably denied that I did a lot of that stuff, but I certainly did.
Were you going to church? Did you guys go to church?
I was raised Catholic, yep. So we went to church every Sunday, just more of a have to than a want to.
Did you believe in God, though? Did you have a sense there was a God out there?
I think I did. I think I did have a sense there was a God, yeah. Yeah, I got.
So you're a hockey guy. You know, they kind of are on the edge anyway. So a little drinking, smoking, it's kind of what they do.
Yeah, exactly.
We
did
anyway.
I'm curious as to where the anger came from. What was beneath the anger that was?
I think it came from just the way I was brought up. My parents did their best job, but they were very young. And they were, you know, they had their own issues. So those issues of, like, verbal and physical violence were around the house. And I you know, I love both my parents dearly. God rest my mom's soul, but yeah, they were young parents, and they didn't know the best way to handle a kid that was kind of wild, if you will, not real good in school, so at an early age, I put up some really strong walls after experiencing some of their parenting. I just put up a lot of walls that I didn't want to be treated in a certain manner ever again, and I think that's where the violence came from. I wanted to be treated in a different manner. Yet, you know, I wasn't getting good grades in school, so I think they were trying their best to be really good parents and really wanted the best for me, yet they just didn't know how to do that. You know, they did not know how to do that. I remember I got to the treatment center at the Salvation Army, and, you know, my dad, I went out and had lunch. You get off a restriction, you get your first 30-day pass, so I called my dad up, and we went out and had some ice cream. And at the end of it, you know, he said, well, if this doesn't work, why don't you just go jump off a bridge and kill yourself? And, you know, by the way, you caused our divorce. But I know my dad loves me. He's a good man. He didn't know how to deal with what I was experiencing. Sure. He wants the best for me. So my dad's a great guy. I love my dad. But he didn't know how to handle this, you know, a 55-year-old man that's living in his car, that's had a lot of assault charges with the law. He wanted the best. Like any dad, I'm a dad. I want the best for my son, so I don't blame my dad. I had to go to the Lord with it because I was still new in treatment. I was like, Lord, help me with this because I wanted to play the poor me card, you know, poor me, poor Ricky. And so I went to the Lord with it, and he said, you know what, you need to write your dad a letter of apology and said, Dad, you did a great job, man, because he did do a great job. My dad was awesome. You know, he did his best is what I'm trying to say. Did he make mistakes? Yeah, but I made mistakes as a parent too, so... But yeah, that's where that violent edge came from, and it stuck with me a long, long, long time, and it determined my destiny. I mean, I went on to play in the USHL, and my dad would come to watch me play, and I was always in the stands with him. He never got to watch me play because I was in a fight the night before, and we had the college fighting rule back when I got in the league. It wasn't the pro fighting rule where they just took you out for 5 minutes, so I'd be up in the stands with my dad every time. I was living in Des Moines playing for the Des Moines Buccaneers, and I'd come up to Minneapolis and play the St. Paul Vulcans or the Bloomington Junior Stars. I'd always be sitting next to my old man because I'd gotten in a fight the night before. So
all right with us. Okay, let's roll back then before we get to the USHL and junior hockey. So you got through high school okay.
Yeah, made it through high school. Was a gentleman. My dad always said, get gentleman C's. So I did. I got my gentleman C's. And, you know, you'll always go on and you'll be a salesman someday and you'll make good money like I did. And, you know, things will work out in your life. So.
And then everything's good. And you kept playing hockey, so you went to the junior league, which was really a good league. It still is.
Yep. I was recruited, drafted by the Austin Mavericks. And my parents had split up that summer. That my dad walked out of the house my senior year. And I'd just gone to a fellowship, a Christian athlete camp. I knew something was always kind of wrong with me, that I was kind of violent and different in certain ways. And I knew I needed Jesus. And I come back from this Christian camp. I said this prayer. I said, God, come into my life, come into my heart. And as I'm walking in the door, my dad's taking all his shirts out the garage, through the garage. I'm going, what in the heck, man? So that hit me pretty hard. And, you know, I even said, God, I just became a born-again Christian. Here you are walking out the door, you know. And he didn't know what to make of that, but he was on his way out. And yeah, it was a tough summer. You know, I'd gotten drafted by the Austin Mavericks and went down and had a terrible tryout. And I still wanted to play, so they traded my rights to the Buccaneers and wound up going down there and having a little better tryout and making the team. But even making the team, the veterans were coming after me, and I had to some guy hit me in between the legs with a stick, and I turned around and broke his nose. I mean, I was going to defend myself at all costs, and I wasn't going to be anybody's victim anymore as it related to violence and violent behavior. So
I was never afraid of him until just now. Seriously.
Well, that's because you're smart. You know? Are you right or left-handed, Rick? Just, anyway, so the hockey dream was what, to get a D1 scholarship?
Absolutely, to get a D1 scholarship. I wasn't ready for school. School didn't mean anything to me. I was just there to play sports.
So when did you know that wasn't going to happen?
I kind of figured it out when I was in Des Moines. I got kicked off the team. I was a Edina guy. We don't know how to jack up a car very well. So I tried to stick the car jack under the side of my door. It was a big boat, 1975 Impala, about 45 feet long. And, you know, you stick a jack underneath the side of the door, and when the jack snaps and hits you in the head, I took the jack and beat my car for about an hour with it. As blood was trickling down my head, and I couldn't figure out why that didn't work. You know, Edina guys aren't very mechanical, I guess. My dad wasn't, so he couldn't show me anything like that. But so then, you know, it got back to the coach, and the coach pulls me in the locker room, and I'd been playing pretty good, and all of a sudden he goes, "We got to send you home, man." He goes, "That's just kind of crazy. And these people are afraid of you that you're living with. You know, you live with a host family, and they must have looked out the window and seen this guy going crazy." So so they sent me home, and so I ended up going up to college just to kill some time, and I terrorized the dorm rooms up there, and I think I met with the president, and some kid's dad drove all the way up from Minneapolis. I think his dad was a doctor, and said, "My son's terrified to go to college with this guy. He's running around dorm rooms threatening people and beating himself on the head with a phone." This was me, of course. And so, you know, this provost is defending me because this guy's, you know, making all these wild accusations, and probably didn't need to defend me. It was probably all true. But the guy wanted a piece of me right in the office. So this poor kid's dad just wanted his poor kid to get an education. He didn't realize who was going to college with the terrorist. So then I found my way onto the football team because I needed more impact and more energy, aggressiveness, and the football players accepted me readily. So at UMD, and of course Jim Malosky, the coach up there, he found out who I was right away. I was a different dude. I was a third stringer, and he knew my name and grabbed me by the face mask several times and told me, "You don't have any discipline," and I didn't have any discipline. I was kind of a wild cowboy running around his football field, trying to smash everybody in sight. So, but they like that, I think. They like, football guys like when there's violence on the practice field, and they like when there's fists swinging. And
did you graduate?
I eventually did graduate. I graduated later on. I did. I went back to UMD. My wife was an attorney up there at the time, and I'd just been kind of in and out of the wrestling and boxing worlds.
Okay,
and
I didn't mean to get ahead there. So
No,
we got to do that, I think, after we come back from the break. I think there's
a
lot more.
I'll be listening, I'll tell you.
Yeah, yeah. And if you ever feel, like, mad towards George, feel free to hit him.
Wouldn't be the first time.
No, I'm just saying. I mean,
I have a very punchable face,
yes,
as you like
do.
To say.
I've said that before, and I'll say it again. All right, you're listening to Real Recovery, Bill, George, Ted, and we've got our very special guest, Rick, in studio. So don't go anywhere. I know you're excited to hear more about his story, so stay tuned. We'll be right back.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Real Recovery.
Welcome back to Real Recovery. Bill, George, Rick in studio. Fascinating story so far, George.
A little scary for me, Bill.
Me too.
I like that we put Sinatra on. Maybe that'll calm him down a little bit. No, interesting guy, great guy. We want to go back, Bill, here, because I asked you, and you got ahead of me a little bit. You got it out of school and then went back. But what did you do after you left school the first time?
I dropped out of school and became a professional wrestler.
What?
Yeah.
But they have an ad in the paper, or what happened?
I was lifting at hardcore weightlifting gyms. In fact, I even ran into a guy named Bill Arnold down at one of the gyms I was at years ago. But Hulk Hogan and some other guys were running around these gyms. But a lot of the gyms had wrestlers in them at the time, and I was kind of a wayward, lost soul and was looking at these great, big, giant, muscular wrestlers. And I was starting to get large and in charge and putting on some bulk. and decided to jump into that mix. And that's a tough world, the mix of professional wrestling world. I got a trainer that was a noted tough guy and a gun-toting tough guy. He trained me in the business. And
Eddie Sharkey.
Eddie Sharkey was my trainer. Yeah, that's right. Good memory. Yeah.
So to get bigger, were you taking any steroids?
I did. Then I got in the foray of steroids when I was actually 18 years old. I started shooting steroids.
Did that make you more violent?
It did. It made me more aggressive and more violent. And ironically, when I got off steroids, this is a message for all the kids out there, I got the strongest. I'd been off steroids for 13 years, and I was a 34-year-old man. I was bench pressing 435 pounds without being on steroids for 13 years. So you don't need steroids to get big and strong. I thought you did at the time. So message out to the kids out there, they're not necessary. You can achieve anything you want to if you put the hard work in there. But, yeah, so I did. I started taking steroids. They make you violent. And I was a guy that my whole life was built on being a tough guy, and a tough guy I did become. So, yeah, I got into the professional wrestling world, and that's a world of tough guys. So I wasn't sure when I first got in my first match. It took me a few months to figure out that wrestling was fake. Someone didn't tell a lot of the guys in the ring, apparently, because I was getting the hell beat out of me. And I was like, man, wow, I'm not sure I signed on for this. My first time in the ring, I got a concussion, knocked out cold. That was in training camp. That wasn't even my first television match or one of my first matches. But, yeah, I dropped out of school, and all these moms said, well, you'll never make it. And a year and a half later, I was on TV. So, but at any rate, yeah, I got in there with the tough guys and took bump after bump after bump, learned how to fall so I didn't get killed or break my neck. And, I mean, I took so many bumps, I was coughing up blood. So, but that was all part of the tough guy persona. I wanted you to know how tough I was, how much I could endure, how much I could take. That was all part of my protecting myself and my image and never wanting to get hurt again or experience any kind of physical or mental anguish or pain. So I put on a real tough guy image, yeah, and got into the pro wrestling world did that for a lot of years, traveled all over the world. I wrestled in Japan. I did television here in the United States and in Canada, a television program in Canada too. So, yeah, that was my 15 seconds of fame. And then
did you like it?
I loved pro wrestling. It was great. It gets in your blood. It's Hollywood slash physicality. So I absolutely loved it, yeah. And I didn't. The lifestyle was a little crazy, even though I did like to party. These guys party like rock stars all night long, and I just was always the guy up at 8 o'clock asking them if they wanted to go work, and they were telling me to get the heck out of their rooms. Get out of here. What are you doing up this early? But they'd eventually get to the gyms, too, and get there and get their workout in, but not at 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning when I was ready to go. So I was kind of a voyeur for the most part. I'd stand back and watch all the madness and the chaos, fortunately, because I had way too many assaults already on my record to get involved in any kind of violence. I had a bunch of assault charges already, so I stood back and let those guys kind of terrorize the bars, if you will, or whatever they were doing. But there was a lot of ugliness to that, and I must have known God because I saw the ugliness, and the way those men operated their lives was nothing I wanted to aspire to. It's just that rock star life is a lonely, empty life, and it's a dark life, and I sensed the darkness. And I kept my distance from a lot of the darkness. Thank God I was no angel, but there was some stuff going on there that just wasn't appropriate for me and my lifestyle. So not to be holier than thou, it's a rough world when you get involved in the show business type world. So
don't tell us. We got an award-winning radio show. So is there kind of a... Is it addicting to beat people up? I mean, I would think there's got to be some rush there, isn't it?
Well, the sad part is I never liked it.
I've always been on the other end of that.
Yeah, but, no, I never liked it. The rush came. I got into boxing, professional boxing, too, during my wrestling career. I had a big-time boxing manager, Ronnie Peterson, got me in the boxing world. He said, well, you're a tough guy. You've had all these street fights. You want to try it? I said, sure. And my mom, I was sitting on the couch one day at the house, and I was beaten up the night before in a street fight, just black and blue and bloody mess. She came over to the house I was living at, and she said, well, why don't you do this for a living? She said, you might as well at least get paid for it. So I said, okay. So I talked to Ronnie Peterson. He got me in the fight world, and I had my first fight over at the Roy Wilkins Auditorium in front of about 2,500 people. And I'd been in the pro wrestling ring, right? So the pro wrestling ring is... if you touch a guy too hard, that's you're violating the code, you know. So the guys that were best in the wrestling business, they looked like they were killing you, but they were barely touching you, the good ones. So at any rate, so I get in the ring, I'm all whipped up. I go up and we're, you touch gloves before the fight, and I go, hey, I go to the other boxer, I go, hey, Bill, how the heck you doing? He looked at me with this horrified look because I was about as relaxed and comfortable as you could be in a ring, right? Well, the bell rings, and he hits me with a left jab right in the nose. I went, oh, my God, this ain't pro wrestling. My eyes are watering. I'm going, uh-oh, here we go. So game on, yeah. So I knocked him out in the third round, and that was the start of my boxing career. I think I kind of swung like a girl. I was, like, swinging from left, right, outfield. Not to insult any girls out there, but, I mean, I wasn't much of a boxer, to tell you the truth. I was throwing, like, windmill haymakers from outfield, left field, right field. And so that was my first illustrious win. But I went on to find out. I fought some guys all in Africa, Finland, France, and I found out the real boxers are really tough and they're really good. And I got my claim to fame in boxing is I got beat up on every continent in the world. So it turns out I wasn't a great boxer. Yeah, I could street fight because there's no rules. You can cheat in street fighting. You can do anything you want in a street fight. But in a legitimate professional boxing match, I got my butt handed to me more than a few times. Although I did win in Helsinki, Finland. I went over there with a bunch of black kids from Gary, Indiana, and a trainer, and they could not believe the white boy won. That was like I was losing every round. It was a 6-round fight in Helsinki, and losing every single round. They didn't put my stool in the corner at the end of the 5th round of a 6-round fight, so I was losing every round. And all you want is your stool and your water bottle in between rounds. And I said, you know, I was squaring and screaming, and where's my stool? By that time, the bell rings, right? I turn around and knock the guy out. So I have the surprised look on my face. I'm standing over this guy in the Finland newspaper with my mouth wide open, just completely shocked that I won. So I actually won twice out of my illustrious boxing career. I think I lost 7 times and won twice. So yeah, I had a wife at home that I was more afraid to come home to her with a mark on my face than I was to face my opponent. So I decided smartly to get out of boxing and save my brain. And because I did get beat up everywhere I was. When your hair hurts 2 days later from a fight, first of all, you wake up with blood all over your pillow the next morning. That's always fun to look at. And then literally my hair hurt on my scalp 2 days later. I said, man, maybe I'll get out of this business. This is not a lot of fun. So,
wow.
But, no, getting back to your original question, yeah, as many fights as I got in, I never liked any of the fights when I was in them. And I wish I'd never done them. And they were always preventable, too. So, sadly, they were always preventable. And I got in a lot of trouble from those. So, so deep down, I had a conscience somewhere. And I must have had a sense of God all along because he saved me from doing a lot of damage. So
to go back when you became a Christian,
mm-hmm.
did you just kind of, okay, I got that. I got this insurance policy. Put it in my back pocket, and I'm going to live my life. Did you do that?
Well, I was 18 years old, and my dad was walking out the door, so I forgot about Jesus till I was about 50, and I was out in the oil fields. And I'd run a gym for a while, and I sold my gym. I was kind of always a high-anxiety guy all my life, too, by the way. Well, that came probably with the violence, but sold a gym kind of impulsively and that I owned and was successfully running, and decided to go out to Vegas and become a superstar gambler. And that didn't work so well.
Were you a 21 player?
I was a blackjack player, slots player. Yeah, I like to play the high stakes because I like to get my heart started, and the big money got my heart started. So, you know, you're an athlete. You think you're competing when you're gambling. There's no competition involved there at all. It's all luck, and there's no skill involved. It's called luck, and so yeah. The problem with gambling is you get drawn in because you get some big wins. So I won, you know, maybe $80,000 to $100,000, and I turned around and probably lost triple that. So, you know, it broke me of everything I had, and that's how I wound up at the Salvation Army. It was a gambling / drinking addiction and a violent past that I was tired of living and knew I needed help. So it came at a time where I was down to my last few bucks. I'm a tough guy, so I came back from the oil fields, and at 50 years old, I decided to get in the concrete business. That's usually a good time to get in concrete when you're 50. And I had to prove to people that I could still do it, and I did it. But you know, I was kind of a rebel there too. You know, in construction, you're supposed to wear a tool belt and have a hammer and a tape measure. And I said, That's not for me. I make the rules here. So I'll shovel dirt and push wheelbarrows and do everything else but use a hammer. They were gracious enough to keep me around because I worked hard and showed up every day. But, again, I wanted to write my own rules. I wanted to make the own laws and kind of a rebellious nature, if you will. And that's where that all stems from. And the Bible talks about that. No man is righteous at all. You know, without God, we just don't have any natural righteousness in us, you know. So, but anyway, I lost my train of thought. I got too many stories.
That's okay. No. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, I want to hear how God has just absolutely barged into your life in the most glorious way. Because these are all stories I feel like I'm hearing for the first time, George. Yet I know him just to be a man who just has a heart on fire for the Lord.
You know the finished product, Bill.
I do. That's exciting. I can't even believe some of these stories I'm hearing. We'll take a little break. Listen to Real Recovery. We'll be right back.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Real Recovery.
Welcome back to Real Recovery. Bill, George, Ted on the board, and Rick in studio. And this is what I affectionately call the very best part of the show, George. We get to hear what Jesus is doing in the life of Rick.
Absolutely, Bill.
Yeah. So it's been quite a story. If you've missed any of this, I promise you need to go to myfaithradio.com, go to the Real Recovery page, and hit from the beginning. You're not going to want to miss any of these details.
I'm going to listen to this. Normally, I don't listen to our show. But this one I'm going to listen to because of...
Thanks for sharing that with me, George. that means a lot to me.
No, it does.
Yeah. My, oh, my. Okay, Rick, let's get to the glorious part of this story.
Well, here's the glorious part. Ironically, guys, before I ever went to the Salvation Army, which eventually turned out to save my life, I used to listen to your show every Sunday night and religiously every Monday morning and just play it over and over and over again. You two guys bantering back and forth with each other would bring on a guest that... kind of like myself, that had a life that was really different, and then he went through an experience with Jesus Christ and came out on top. And I thought I could get it through listening by the radio through osmosis, and I guess God doesn't work that way. You have to actually go in and do some work and surrender yourself to him and his ways. And I was desperate, and I had what drove me, I'd lost a bunch of money gambling, and I'd borrowed that money, and I'd always paid back the people I'd borrowed from, always never missed. And this time I missed. I went right back out and gambled and lost it. And it wasn't a large sum of money either, but I said, that's it, I'm done, I'm sick. And people had told me before, why do you keep doing this? They'd ask me, my dad, my boxing promoter, I'd always borrow from my boxing manager. He's my Mick. He'd been on my side forever. And they'd always ask me, why do you keep doing this? I couldn't give him an answer. So obviously I had a problem, right? So anyway, I got into the Salvation Army and just humbled myself, checked in there, and it's a beautiful place where God is ever present. So God was just in there from the moment I stepped in those doors. So I was very hungry to find Jesus. I based my whole program on getting a new heart and getting a new spirit and getting a new mind, and these are all scriptures that affected my life that are right out of the Bible, and I was very, very hungry. So you're supposed to take X amount of classes a week, 4 classes a week, for instance, and I was taking 8, and I couldn't get enough. Bill Arnold would come in every Friday night and speak life into us. We have a resident manager every morning that would come in and speak life into us. George Fraser would come out and speak life through recovery into us. I didn't know what AA was. I didn't know what the 12 steps were, no idea. Didn't know what addiction was. I just thought I was just kind of a violent man with some issues with gambling. And gambling, I kind of knew there was something more to that. And the drinking, I was just walking around dead inside. So, but I came to the Salvation Army and prayed to the Lord, and the Lord is ever present in church, and reached out and cried out to him many, many nights and many days. And he answers when you cry out in prayer. And I wanted change. I wanted to be a different guy. I didn't want to be a violent man. I have a big heart. I love people. I love to be around people. When you're a tough guy, you isolate all the time. When you're an addict, you isolate all the time. You don't want to be around goodness. And so I was really hard the first 60, 70 days at the Salvation Army, man. I was so used to chaos and walking on the edge that being loved and being comforted every day felt uncomfortable to me. as weird as that sounds. I couldn't handle all that love and all that acceptance and all that goodness. I was used to being on edge and being on the fray and being jaggedy is the best way I can describe it, a jagged adrenaline, crazy feeling that's not normal. When you sit still with God, there's a lot of peace, there's a lot of joy, there's a lot of stillness that I'd never, ever had my whole life, ever. And that stillness and that peace and that joy was like God just wrapping his arms around me and holding me in his arms and saying, I've always been there for you. I've always loved you, Ricky, and I always will. And I only got that through you guys preaching that message to me about Jesus Christ. He'll never leave you. He'll never forsake you. And it became real to me because I cried out to him enough and asked for him, for his presence. And he showed up many times. I had a hip replacement. This Salvation Army is so good to me. Tom and Trudy Canfield are so good to me. They let me have my hip replaced while I was going through treatment. And I'm going to have another one done. But the pain was so excruciating one night that I was literally physically crying and crying out to the Lord and wondering how I was going to handle the pain and stay calm. And he just answered me and hugged me and wrapped me in his arms. And the next day I was fine. So I got through it. But when you cry out to him, he does answer, and he has showed up in my life and changed my life. I love the men of the Salvation Army. I never thought I'm a kid from the suburbs. I never thought I could hang around with street people. I love these guys. They were the reason I got through my program, as the other men in the program inspired me. I had every gift growing up that a kid could ever have, and these kids, a lot of them grew up with nothing. They didn't have anything, no mom and dad, no role models, and I had all that stuff. I had every opportunity to have a good life, and I chose not to. So God brought me to the Salvation Army. I didn't know why I was there. I didn't know anything about treatment. I didn't know what the Salvation Army was. I thought salvation meant it was like a salvage yard. I didn't realize that I was a Christian, too. Salvation means being saved by Jesus Christ, and that if you ask Jesus Christ into your heart and life, you're going to be saved, and you're going to live with him forever in eternity. And, oh, by the way, when you're on earth, you're going to have a pretty darn good life, too. And so now my kids know Jesus Christ. They're blessed. My son is going to be a doctor at Baylor University. He's studying down there, and he knows the Lord, and he doesn't drink or smoke. My daughter, same thing. She knows the Lord, and she's still a junior in high school and doing really well. So the Lord has blessed me with all these miracles of physical healing, of spiritual healing, of my kids being well. And the Bible talks about all these things. It talks about if you are obedient to me and follow me, you will have a better life here on earth, but you'll also live with me in heaven. And that doesn't mean I don't have problems every day. I don't face problems with family, with friends, with things popping up. But I know that I have a Savior I can turn to and confess my sins to, and I am forgiven instantly. And I have a peace and a joy that I've never, ever experienced in my life. So I've never been happier. I've been a business owner. I've been a pro athlete on TV. I've been all these things, a hockey player, all these things, and I've never been as happy as I have been in a treatment center at the Salvation Army with no money, with seemingly no prospects. I don't know where they hire tough guys. I'm not sure there's too many signs out there for guys that want to beat people up, but no, I'm just kidding, but I've changed now. But I mean, no fear of the future, and know that God has me as long as I continue to follow him, that my life will be okay. So,
and God has really gifted you, Rick, because I have watched you interact with men at the Salvation Army, and I will never forget a night that there was another person in the program who was just at the bottom of the end of his rope and tears filling his eyes, and I can't do this, I'm leaving. And I'll never forget what I then watched. You took your hands and you put them on his face. And you said to him, you're going to be fine. You're going to make it. Yeah. I mean, I would never touch George's face. Just as an example.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, that.
But there was that moment of tenderness that's like, this is what a father does for a son. This is a father cups his son's face and says, you're going to make it. You're going to be fine. And I thought, ooh, does this guy have gifts?
Yeah, he does.
And is God going to use him?
You know, there aren't jobs for people to not, you know, beat people up, but there might be an opening to knock somebody around a little bit.
But that's just one of the gifts of the Salvation Army. And I, know, God showed me that in nursing home environment, that people in nursing homes don't often get touched, and he put it upon my heart to stroke people's faces and to caress them and love them in physical ways that they normally would not get touched. So I brought that back to the Salvation Army with me, to men that are hurting, that to give hugs and get hugs and to physically touch people, because I spent a lot of years alone in isolation, and I know what it's like when a guy will come up to you at church when you're all alone at church and get tap on your shoulder and give you a big hug. It's life-changing. It's game-changing. So I've tried to share that with other people that are maybe hurting or maybe not, but they're going to get touched by Ricky Rice. I'm a hugging machine, and I love to hug, and God showed me that. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I didn't know the Ricky before. I wanted to hear your story. I knew it would be fabulous. But I know who you are now, because the finished product we know. And you're a great brother in Christ.
Thank you.
That everybody likes, and God has given you so many gifts. It's so cool to see you using them now for His glory and your joy.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Ricky. Great stuff.
Thanks, George. Rick, I would say, too, I've watched you kind of reset the tone down at the Salvation Army. You've become sort of a point man for the new people that come in, and you connect, you meet people where they're at, you listen to their needs, you comfort them, you give them encouragement and hope. But one of the things that really struck me is when I first met you, you were in the front row with your Bible open and a notebook and a pen in your hand, and I thought, oh, you know, there are a lot of men that come down.
I thought he worked there.
Well, you know, or there's men that come down there, businessmen,
yep,
who do, you know, they sponsor people in AA, and they meet with guys down there, and sometimes they meet with them after the programming.
Yep.
And I thought, oh, look at this guy. He's mentoring somebody down here. First of all, he looks like the, you know, a Fortune 500 CEO, and he's sitting there in the front row taking notes, and his Bible's wide open, and every other guy there may not have a Bible open, but you were just as studious as you could be. You wanted to learn everything you could learn.
Yeah, well, I had a great teacher. That was you, so thank you.
Knock it off, but thank you.
Well, we both shared a good teacher. Jeff Verdorn is a good, was my Bible studies teacher before you,
yeah,
so he's good.
You got a hunger for the Word, too, so you put yourself in a place where, Lord, here I am, teach me, lead me, guide me, and if you're going to get into recovery, and that's going to be your attitude, you're going to have a lot of luck, a lot of blessing.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Luck's not the right word. Blessing is the right word.
Blessing is definitely the right word.
So, George, what do you think?
Great.
Another award-winning
show.
Episode?
I'm going to listen to this one for sure, and I knew it would be good. But as you say, Bill, it's always interesting to see the finished product and then hear the story before it. I feel truly blessed being here, and great, great show, Ricky. Good job.
Thanks, George.
Keep pressing it forward, bud.
Got that right.
Do you have any idea, Rick, what's going to be next, what the Lord's going to have you focus on next?
I don't, but wherever I am, He'll definitely use me. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's
as long as
sure.
You've got your open heart and your availability, God will lead you in exactly where He'll want you.
Yes, no doubt.
Yeah, because I think there's going to be a lot of people that are going to be touched by your life and your experience and your love and your knowledge of the Word, and it is exciting to grow in His Word, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I love His Word. I'm in it every day.
I love it, too. And I hope you can encourage other men who are in recovery, other people in recovery. That is the place you go for joy.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That is the place you find joy.
All right, Georgie boy, that's another award-winning episode we've just put on the books. Thank you, Rick, for being here in studio. It's meant a lot to us.
Yeah, thanks, Bill. Thanks, George.
George and I love
awesome.
You.
Thanks, Ted.
Just so you know, we
thanks
love you.
Thanks for saying
thank
hi
to Ted. Nice to be loved.
Yeah, thanks very much. It's good to have you. Great story. Appreciate it.
Good to see you, Arnold.
So if you missed any of tonight, I really encourage you to go to myfaithradio.com and you go to the Real Recovery show page. And you can hear Rick's testimony right from the beginning, or you can also pass it along to a friend. Maybe you know someone who has been a big fan of him from his wrestling days, and he's got such a powerful story to tell. You will love passing this on and giving others a chance to hear it. You can just email the link to people. So head over to myfaithradio.com. Thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting Faith Radio. We love you. Thank you, and have a great night. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.